are listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
The city of Pergamos was 55 miles north of Smyrna. Letter number one, message number one, at the beginning of Revelation 2, went from Patmos, where John was in prison, up to Ephesus, about 40-some miles north. The second message was delivered to another seaport city of Smyrna. Then, about 50, 55 miles north, message three was delivered to the city of Pergamos, or Pergama, or Pergamon. There's different ways to pronounce it. 50, 55 miles north of Smyrna, and then about 20 miles inland. So, this was not a port city. This was a landlocked, inland city. And yet it was a large and influential city that dominated the countryside where it was, occupied a lot of land in that region, and was actually the capital city of that area. Now, some things that we need to know about this city. First of all, Pergamos was an idolatrous city. This city featured a lot of idol temples, statues, shrines, groves, places of worship to false gods. Four gods in particular stand out in this city. Now, many gods were worshipped, but four were especially prominent. Two of them were Greek gods from the famous Greek pantheon. These were evidences of deep embedded Greek influence in this city from the years gone by. The first was the god Zeus. This, if you understand the Greek pantheon, was the top god. This was the god at the top of the pile. This was the god Zeus, the god of the sky and of thunder. He also was a god known for his immoral lifestyle. Quite a few of the other lower gods were the results of his profligate lifestyle, according to stories. And so he was the most powerful god, also an immoral god. Also was worshipped in this city, Athena. She was the goddess of wisdom and military victory. She was the goddess that you wanted to go out and fight wars for you, because she was the goddess of victory and wisdom. Two other gods were also prevalent in the city of Pergamos. These were local regional gods. The first was Dionysus. Dionysus was the royal family god of the area, and he was associated with a bull, a male cow. They also worshipped another god of that region called Asclepius. Asclepius was the god of healing and perhaps the most interesting of these four gods. He wasn't portrayed as a bull. He was portrayed as a snake, a slithering serpent. He had a temple shrine in that city as well, and was very respected in that city. Sick people would travel to Pergamos exclusively from all over the world to visit the temple shrine of Asclepius, because he was believed to have special healing power from the gods. And you would receive this healing power at this temple if you would go to Asclepius' temple and feed one of the live snakes that were there. They allowed non-poisonous snakes to reproduce and slither and live all over inside that temple. It was kind of like the snake section of the zoo, only it was actually a temple. Then worshippers who wanted healing after they fed the live snakes would spend the night in that temple. They would lay on the floor. There would be no light. It would be pitch dark. And they would lay in there all night hoping that a snake would touch them, crawl over them, brush up against them. It didn't matter, because if the snake would touch you at night in the darkness, one of them, any of them, they believed you would be healed. And you would have actually received favor and special attention from Asclepius, the god of snakes and of healing. And perhaps that's why we have a snake on the medical symbol today. The city also housed a historic temple that honored both Caesar Augustus and the goddess Roma, which would be the Roman Empire. Shortly after this letter was written, they would go on to erect a second temple in this same city, this time to the Emperor Trajan. And though other cities respected Rome, revered Rome, and had some shrines like Smyrna, we talked about them last week, the city of Pergamus stood out because they were the first to erect a massive temple to Rome and the Caesar itself, himself. And so, because of that, they received great favor from Rome, and this was the seat, the epicenter of Caesar worship, or what historians would call the imperial cult. A similar idea today in many ways, in many respects, would be in Germany prior to World War II, swearing allegiance to the state, or other places in the world, communist countries, requiring that you swear allegiance to the state as your chief protector, benefactor, and leader. And this is what the Roman Empire would do. And so the city at Pergamus was very idolatrous, featured some of these gods a lot and others, and was the seat of the imperial Roman cult. Pergamus was also an educated and innovative city. This city would, not long again after this letter was written, would produce a man named Galen. Galen would go on to become the second most influential and well-known medical doctor, apart from Hippocrates, who would go on to be the number one medical doctor of ancient times. They would produce the second most influential medical doctor. More importantly, though, this city introduced the production of parchment. That's what the word Pergamum means, parchment. Parchment has an interesting story. The city of Pergamus rivaled the great city Alexandria, Egypt, by its large and growing library project. They were amassing volumes of literature and records and documents on a very large scale that was rivaling the city of Alexandria, which was well known for its massive library. Well, that was all fine and good, and for them to do this, they would import papyrus from Egypt, which was where the papyrus reeds would grow in the Nile Delta. And so you had to go to Egypt to get your paper. You didn't just go to Target and buy it in the school section or Home Depot or, Office Depot, Office Max or whatever, Staples. You had to go down to Egypt and get it imported up to wherever you were. And so that's what they did. But when Ptolemy Epiphanes, a major Greek leader in Alexandria, found out that they were importing paper from Egypt to compete with Egypt's library, he cut off trade of papyrus to that part of the world. He did not want to compete with their library. He wanted to have the greatest library. Well, the people of Pergamum were not deterred, and so they came up with an alternative form of documenting things. That was parchment. Parchment was using animal skins, leather essentially, to write on instead, which created a more durable writing surface actually. And so because of economic demands and competition, They actually innovated a new form of technology for writing and communication. And we're still doing that today, right? When one form of tech is replaced by another better form of tech. And some of that is often driven by trade demands and tariffs and all these kind of things, creating need and spurring innovation. And that's something that happened in Pergamos. So this is some background on the city. Now let's get into our letter. Christ introduces himself, says, to the angel of the church in Pergamos, write, these things says he who has the sharp two-edged sword. What does this mean? He also says this again in verse 16, right? He says, repent or else I will come to you quickly and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. And so this is a picture, word picture, that he wants to emphasize in his message to this church in this city. Of course, you probably know, if you've been following this series, that this description of Christ is borrowing a detail from John's exalted vision of Christ in Revelation chapter 1. In this case, he's borrowing the detail that out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword. And perhaps you remember when we talked about this, that this sword was not, the word that's used, a slender fencing stick or something of that nature, but was a broad two-edged sword designed to chop off people's heads and to fight with the big guys. This was a big and a massive, destructive, violent sword. And so this is the picture that is presented. The one who has the sharp two-edged sword coming from his mouth. This description reminds us as the readers and the original audience that the punishing, conquering power of God's word was more impressive than anything else that put pressure upon them in this world. Of course, they lived under the shadow of Zeus and Athena. I mentioned Zeus earlier. Zeus actually had a large, massive, oversized, big altar edifice up on the top hill of the city that just hung over the entire skyline. They also were dealing with the shadow of ardent Caesar worship in this city. This is the epicenter of Caesar worship. And so there was this also this thing called the local proconsul, which is the local Roman governing body of authorities. And in fact, if you lived in other cities around the area, you would have to go to Pergamum to be tried by that particular proconsul. It was the proconsul for that area and was the only ruling body in that area that had authority to give the death sentence. They truly did have the power of the sword hanging over them in Pergamos. But despite these imposing realities, Christ reminded the believers that he wielded the greater sword. More powerful than the Greek gods, the Caesars, the Roman Empire could ever wield. John, of course, I want you to turn to Revelation 19, verses 15 to 21. John will refer to this sword again near the end of our study. Let's preview that. When Christ returns at the Battle of Armageddon, he is going to defeat all the armies and technologies of the world prior to the millennial kingdom. And here's how John describes that. Revelation 19, 15. He says, now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword that with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. And then if you skim down to verse 21, John says, and the rest were killed with the sword, which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. So we are not to be worried about what sword may pierce our neck, because we know the one who holds the greater sword will defeat our enemies in the end. We also need to be aware, then, of this positive assessment of the church's spiritual condition. There is a positive assessment in this letter. There is also a negative evaluation. And this is one of those letters that is balanced in that sense. It's not a letter that only has one side or the other. This is the kind of parent-teacher conference that usually happens, right? Your child is doing well in these ways. The parent's smiling, waiting, but, that's the key word, in this class, your child is not doing very well. And so let's see what the positive assessment is. Christ says some very positive things about this city, this church, rather. They lived valiantly in the center of the imperial cult. Notice what he says. He connects his feedback to the special challenges of their situation in their city, in their environment. He said, I know your works. And then how does he qualify that? I know where you live. Now, this isn't a threat. I know where you live and I'm going to come get you. No, this is a, I know where you live in what you're dealing with. During the real epicenter of the COVID pandemic, I had people reaching out to me from other parts of the U.S. that were relatively untouched by the virus because we live in Corona, right by the East Elmhurst Hospital, where everything is happening. And how are you doing, Thomas? They would say, we know that you're in the center of things. That's kind of the idea here. Christ is saying, look, I know the world is bad, but I know your works. I know where you live. I know what you're dealing with there in Pergamos. It's a tough place to be. And notice how he continues to describe their location. He says, it's where Satan's throne is. And then he adds later, it's where Satan dwells. You ever drive into a town? It could be a small town like where I grew up. And I think this is actually what it says. Welcome to Spencer, Indiana, the home of the annual Apple Butter Festival. Say, what is apple butter? And what is an apple butter festival? Don't worry, it's not that big of a deal. But then you might drive into another major city like Philadelphia. Welcome to Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. Well, what about the city of Pergamos? Welcome to Pergamos, the place where Satan lives. That's not a glowing review of this location. And what Christ is saying is, I know that you live in a tough spot. I know you live in Pergamos where Satan lives. So let's just give you some bonus points for that. That is a work in and of itself. The idea that you're not just visiting, right? It's the idea that you're living there. You're dwelling there. You've put your tent pegs down. You poured your foundation in the city where Satan dwells. You're not passing through for a weekend to see the sights and then going back to your nice Christian community in a very tolerant city. You actually live there generation after the next, and you keep on living there. That's amazing. And so that's what Christ is saying. He is giving them a pat on the back, blessings for living where Satan lives. You know, some people have to do that. Some of us have to live in worse places than others. And just doing that deserves some attention from Christ, doesn't it? I know we all want to live in that nice, posh, relaxed, perfect Christian neighborhood with no crime, and every teacher in the public school is a Christian, and all the churches are good and get along, and the pay is good, and the air is fresh. That's where we all want to live, isn't it? But guess what? Some of us have to live where Satan is, where it's more difficult, spiritually speaking. That's a work in and of itself. What does it mean where Satan lives? I think generally speaking, it simply means there was an elevated, heightened, intensified presence of Satan's work in that city. But we have to then ask the question, why? Through what means? What was the platform for him to do this? There are various options and possible explanations for this. Some people suggest that this is a reference to that great, oversized Zeus temple up on the top of the hill that hung over them. Some would say that this is referring to the Asclepius temple. I kind of like that interpretation because Satan is a snake, right? And that's the temple of the snake god. But that's probably not what he's speaking about. That's giving a little bit too much credit to Asclepius, I think, who was not even a major god. So that is something also that I would take with a grain of salt. I think the best way to explain this is to recognize the oversized, heightened degree of the imperial cult's influence in the city. Yes, throughout the Roman Empire, it was required to worship Caesar, but one historian, one commentator has explained it this way. In most other cities, there was this threat of once a year having to burn incense to the Roman Caesar and say, oh, I worship you as God or whatever, and I set aside all my other religious beliefs as secondary to Caesar. But in this particular city, you might be called upon to do that any day of the year. It was a very heightened trial in this particular city. It was a daily trial that you lived under, this potential. And on top of that, the proconsul was right down the road. It wasn't far away. They were right in your backyard. The sword would fall right in your community. And in fact, if other people were going to be tried for treason, they would most likely be brought to your city to be tried, because that was the place where the executions would have been ordered. And so this was probably what John is referring to. It would then be because Satan, in fact, is using the Roman Empire as his ruse, his platform, to steal allegiance away from Christ. Instead of just showing up and saying, hey, I am Satan, worship me, which most Christians just wouldn't do. In fact, most non-believers probably wouldn't do it if they actually saw him for real. So what he's doing then is he's taking professing believers and other people, and he's requiring them to make Caesar and the Roman state their top preeminent authority. That is an anti-Christ strategy. And if he can get believers and other people, non-believers as well, to swear premium allegiance to the state, then all other allegiances are secondary. And it doesn't matter if you worship Christ in a secondary capacity, because to worship Christ in a secondary capacity is not to worship him at all. He's either Lord of all or he's not Lord at all. And Satan knows this. He is the one who is masterminding, trying to find a way to anti-Christ. And he was doing this through the Roman Empire. And so this is what believers were up against in this city. It was a heightened form of imperial cult worship that was breathing down their neck in their backyard, unlike any other places in this part of the world. Another thing that is mentioned by Christ that is positive is that they learned from an exemplary martyr in their past. Some years before, Antipas is the name of this man. This fellow stood out as a witness for Christ, because he stood up as a witness for Christ and was killed as a result. Now, the Roman Empire, this is important, did not execute people for refusing to worship Zeus or Asclepius or some other regional or Greek god. They did not kill you for that. You could pick and choose your patron gods. It was up to you what you did with the gods. All they demanded on threat of death was that you swear allegiance to Caesar first of all. And so it was only swearing allegiance or not to Caesar and the Roman state that could earn you execution. Not bowing to these other gods was irrelevant to the Roman Empire. So, this man, Antipas, was a faithful witness for Christ. He embraced the person the teaching of Christ, and was loyal to the point where he refused to bow the knee to Caesar and the Roman Empire. And because of that, was killed. It's interesting if you study church history that Antipas is not mentioned anywhere else. You would think maybe if he's mentioned here, he was a well-known person in church history. We don't see him mentioned anywhere else in other records. We do read about other Christians being executed for their faith in Pergamos. In fact, it was in this city that the well-known man Polycarp, decades later, would refuse to deny his allegiance to Christ and was therefore burned at the stake. And then while he was burning, stabbed through his heart. Because of his faith in Christ, he refused to do that. Now, as believers, we pay taxes. We obey the government. We do what we're supposed to do. But we never treat the government as superior to God himself. That's where we draw the line. And this man knew that. What it seems to be saying here is that this man was probably, if I understand it correctly, was probably brought in from an outlying area outside of the city, tried for his faith, would not recant, and was publicly martyred as an example to everybody. And in spite of that, the believers in Pergamos continued to stand for their faith and did not allow his example to cause them to back up. And so Christ is telling them, I know the kind of place you're living in. And I also know that even when Antipas at the beginning was martyred, that didn't stop you. You kept standing loyal to my faith. And history seems to indicate that more of them continued to be executed along the way, following his example. So up to this point, you have good feelings about this church, and you think to yourself, this must have been a very good church. So what does Jesus know about this church that's negative? Here's what we find. Despite the church's loyalty to Christ, in the face of great pressure from the imperial cult, they also, on one hand, were resisting Satan's influence faithfully. On the other side, they let down their guard on another aspect that was important. This is like if you know stories that have dragons in them, right? Dragons are big and scary and you can't defeat them. They breathe fire and they fly and they have powerful, impenetrable scales. But to defeat that dragon, you have to know where its sweet spot is. There's some spot somewhere right on the dragon. If you can stab it there, you can kill it. So, Satan's mind, he wants to steal people away from following Christ as Lord, as God. And if he can't do it through the power of the state, he'll find the sweet, soft underbelly somewhere and try to get in through our weakness. And sometimes our weakness simply is, we put so much energy and effort into standing for Christ in one way that we don't have what it takes to stand for him any other way. And we have to be careful of that. We don't let down our guard. It says in this passage that the things he had against them was that they had among them those who held to the doctrine of Balaam. And they had among them those who held to the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which, as you remember, the church at Ephesus had Nicolaitan influence and rejected it. This particular church didn't reject it. They just let it come in. Now, the way that these two groups are mentioned indicate they are probably distinct groups that taught similar things. My interpretation of this is looking at it, if they're teaching the same things, the main difference here is the Balaamites would be more of a Jewish-oriented group, familiar with the Jewish Old Testament, the influences of the Old Testament, Balaam, and so forth. The other group, the Nicolaitans, would have been more of a Greek-oriented Gentile group, both kind of coalescing around the same ideas. What were these ideas? Well, to understand what these groups promoted, taught, and so on, it's important to understand the story of Balaam in the Old Testament. Now, let me add to this that at the beginning of this letter, Jesus says in his positive assessment, I know you, where you live, and where Satan's throne is, that you are holding to your faithfulness to me, to my faith. That word holding to is an active verb that means you started and you keep on doing it. You keep on holding to the doctrine, the faith of Christ. But then he says, among you, and then he uses the same word two more times, there are some of you among you that are holding to the doctrine of Balaam and are holding to the doctrine of Nicolaitans. And the idea is you can try to keep on holding to the doctrine of Christ, but you can't do that and then kind of over here hold some false doctrines too. You can't keep doing that. But some of you are trying to do that. And some of you are tolerating others who are trying to do that. And you can't keep doing that. My question to you tonight is, are you trying to take a stand for Christ, but hold on to some other things anti-Christ at the same time? If so, you need to diagnose that and stop. Now, to understand the story of Balaam, here's the basic storyline. In the Old Testament, the nation of Israel was coming from Egypt into the Promised Land, and the Amalekite people were enemies of Israel. Israel was defeating people and winning military victories. They came up close to where Amalek was, and the king of the Amalekites, Balak, got afraid. And so he went to a man who was a prophet for hire. He could give prophecies, and he would do it for money. And so he went to this man, Balaam, and he said, I need you to throw out some curses for me. If you can do that, I will give you a lot of money, and I will make you a very important person. But the people of Israel are getting close. I do not want them to defeat my people and take my land. So I want you to curse them. Get God to curse them because their God is the one who needs to do that. They're too powerful for me to do that and our people to do that. And Balaam, he wanted the money. And so he tried a few times, but each time he said, I can't. I cannot curse God's blessed, chosen people. But if you read, that was Numbers 24, if you want to read the whole story. Then in Numbers 25, we read about another event that happened. What happened was Balak and the Amalekites took a different approach. If we can't get them to be cursed by God, he's going to protect them. Then they went to the Israelites and invited them to a great festival feast of their gods. We're going to have a great festival feast to our gods, and you are traveling through. You know what? Let's be friends. That's the message that's conveying. Sit down at the table with us, and let's be friends. Let's not fight. We'll be good neighbors for you. In fact, you can come. We know you worship another god, but you can come into our festival feast, to our gods, and be our guests. We'll feed you, we'll entertain you, and let you be a part of the festivities. Come on in. And they actually did this. As they were doing this, they were in the middle of actual idol worship, observing, participating as potential friends and guests. But as they did, they also then, the Amalekites brought out their women. And part of the way that they would worship in that pagan festival style involved that very thing. And I won't explain any more, but what they did by that approach and strategy got the men to sin and ruin the reputation. And in fact, God actually had to judge them for that. Interestingly enough, this the Bible attributes in Numbers 31 and verse 16. Also in 2 Peter and the book of Jude in the New Testament, the same story is mentioned. It's a big deal. The women of Amalek caused the children of Israel to trespass against the Lord, very discreetly described as the incident of Peor. We will not discuss the details. It was not a good situation. It was a pagan situation. It was an immoral situation. It was very bad, the incident at Peor. But how did Balak come up with this strategy? You know, it says right here, through the counsel of Balaam. Balaam knew enough about God to know he could not get God to curse his people. But if they could entice God's people to sin, God himself would judge his people, because that is a curse that God himself had given. So the trick then is to get God's people to sin in a way that invokes God's curses. That is exactly the sin of Balaam. And in fact, because of that sexual immorality that happened in this incident at Peor, God ordered the execution of 24,000 Israelite men who had engaged in the immoral acts. And in this way, Balaam weakened the Israelite army and their ability to defeat his people. From what Christ says in this message, the church at Pergamos, to the church at Pergamos, Christians living in that city faced a similar threat. Satan, because of their faithfulness, even to the point of a martyr's death, could not crack their faith and loyalty by forcing them to swear allegiance to the state. And so, he attempted to come in the same way that Balaam advised Balak to do. Come in through idolatrous practices and sexual immorality. Perhaps the believers in that city and that church reasoned, since we're taking such a difficult stand for the faith of Christ, well, maybe we can afford to be a little bit more lenient when it comes to the local pagan religions and their sexual practices. We are taking a stand against the great and mighty imperial cult at the epicenter, where it's the hottest and the thickest. We don't want everyone to be our enemies. We'd like some of the local people to like us. And so those who followed, perhaps from that Greek background, the Jewish background, Balaam, Nicolaitan ideas, let's be loose in our morality. Let's be loose in our pagan practices. Let's mix together. Let's be more culturally, what's the word I'm looking for here? Cultural blending in. Now, there are neutral things in this world, certainly. Not everything is worshiping in an idol and committing sexual immorality. But these are the things, as Christians, we have to avoid. We don't worship in other temples. We don't worship in other places that do not preach the gospel. We do not participate in events like that. And we certainly should not participate in immorality. And yet, these believers allowed some of the people in their church to participate in idol festivals, dabbling in sexual immorality. Some were doing it, believed it was a good thing to teach. You do this to blend in. Others were just simply tolerating it. Some of the people in the church were doing it, and hey, as long as we're all resisting the imperial cult, I think God's going to be okay with that. I think that's the mentality. And Christ said, I'm really glad. I mean, I know where you live. I know what you're up against. I know some of you got killed, and that's not stopped you. But I really hate this other teaching that's getting into your church. That has to stop. And so Christ urged them to repent. If left unchecked, the nation of Israel would have disappeared before they entered the promised land. And that's why God had to step in and order the execution of 24,000 men. Even though it weakened their military ability to defeat their enemies. He had to do it, or there would be no nation of Israel left, and there would be no Messiah. For us today, we are certainly not Israel, but if the church allows immorality and idol practices to creep into our church, affiliating with false religions, then if left unchecked, the witness and testimony of Christ also shrinks from the earth, and that cannot be tolerated. And so we have to be careful. Israel fell to this great deception, and through Moses, God ordered the execution of 24,000 men. And then something else happened. Not long after, the nation of Israel went to battle against other neighboring pagan kings, and they killed them. And in the process of doing that, the Bible says they also killed with the sword Balaam. And so the men who committed those acts were killed with the sword. Balaam was killed with the sword. So what should we do when immorality and other false religions creep into Faith Baptist Church? The deacons pull out their swords. No, that is not what we do, right? Jesus himself taught in John 18:36, "My kingdom is not of this world. It's not a worldly kind of kingdom. If it was, I would tell my servants, followers of Christ, disciples, to fight people with their swords. But I don't do that because that's not how the church functions. That's how a nation functions. That's why Israel used swords. But the church is not a nation like that. We are not a political, social entity. We are a spiritual entity. And so we don't use swords. Instead, Christ simply says, I will have to come quickly and do the dirty work myself. If you don't repent, if you don't stop tolerating immorality and pagan worship among your body, then I'm going to have to quickly come and I'm going to have to slay them with the sword of my mouth. And what is that? It's his word. Not necessarily the preacher is going to preach messages and it's going to cut people up. No. What he's talking about here, it seems, is simply saying, I am going to have to personally, in my presence, come to your church, and I'm going to have to give some instructions that are going to cause death. I'm going to have to come and give some orders out of my mouth that judges and, like surgery, cuts these influences out from your body before the cancer grows and destroys this church that has been standing firm for the faith. After the stern warning of judgment, he gives a promise of personal blessing. I like this blessing. This promise of blessing. It's twofold. The promise of hidden manna. I will give you hidden manna to eat. This is like grandma saying, come to my house and I've got some cookies and candy bars hidden in this special place and I'll show you where they are. It's kind of like that. And then there's also this promise that I think a lot of us would look at and say, the hidden manna, now that's interesting. A white stone with my name on it? That sounds like a trinket from, you know, a roadside plaza or something. You can buy those at the Children's Museum, you know, for $10 when you leave at the gift store. What is a white stone with my name on it? Well, let me explain. To understand the hidden manna, I think we need to understand the white stone. And I think the two will go together. You'll see why. Some rabbis say that this white stone is symbolic of manna, little white things falling out of the sky. That's very speculative. There's really no basis for that kind of thing. Others suggest that this is referring to the 12 gemstones somehow on the breastplate of the high priest in the tabernacle. I failed to see how that helps us either, because my question is, which stone? They were all different kinds of colors. Why is ours white? What's the point of that? Other suggestions are also offered, but there seems to be two possibilities taken from a first century New Testament cultural context that makes the most sense, one more than the other. The first is that these white stones may refer to the common New Testament, when I say New Testament, something that happened in the world during that time, practice of casting stones to determine a jury's verdict. So after a jury would hear a person's case, they would hear both sides, they would deliberate, they would ask their questions, they would arrive at a verdict, they would one by one come up to an urn or a bowl, and they would throw a stone in the bowl. A black stone meant you thought this person was guilty. A white stone meant you thought this person was innocent. And then they would count the stones, how many white, how many, that kind of thing. You say, is that in the Bible anywhere? It is, actually. Acts chapter 26 and verse 10. Paul says that he, as a Pharisee, was persecuting Christians, and he was one of the ones that when they would arrest them, he would throw his stone in against them. He would use his authority, and he would throw black stones out to give bad verdicts on the Christians. And that's what he's talking about when he says he cast his vote. It's the word Cephas, which you probably know means a little stone, right? And that's what he was doing, his vote, his jury vote, a little stone he would throw into the bowl. If this is the thing that's being spoken of, I will give you a white stone, then that would perhaps mean that Christ is saying, I'm going to cast an innocent and righteous verdict for you at the end if you will stand for me now, even if they accuse you of guilt for not bowing to Caesar or something, and if you'll resist sexual immorality. But it doesn't seem the best explanation. It's interesting. These stones didn't have names written on them. There was no detail like that that was relevant. So that seems a bit of a stretch. And Jesus doesn't determine our righteousness based upon a jury's decision. He decides that by himself and himself alone. So I like this other option best. In the Roman Empire at that time, the Roman Empire would sometimes, in the goodness of their hearts, would give away free stuff, stimuluses they would give away. Sometimes it was amounts of food. They would hand out food to the general population. Other times they would give away free access to special entertainment events. And in order to access your fair share of the free stuff that was being given away, you had to produce a white stone. I don't know if it was white. Was it white? I think it was. Stone with a name written on it. And that name would authenticate you as the citizen and that this is authentic. And so you would produce, like today, we would produce a ticket or a card or some kind of VIP number or something like this. A barcode would be scanned. Something of this nature today. Back in those days, you would have to produce. You couldn't just be any random person walking in off the street. You had to show, I'm a Roman citizen. I was given the authority to access this benefit. And you would produce that stone. Also, if you would win at some gladiatory games or some athletic competitions or something like this, it was common practice to give the victors prizes. And one of the prizes you might get is a stone with your name written on it, and it would give you access to a special banquet that you could go to. No one else got to go except for the few and the famous and the successful. This would be like going to an awards banquet for the MLB at the end of the season. Only the people who won awards get to go to this place in New York and sit with famous people and get their awards and eat all this fancy food that I don't even know what the names of it are. That kind of thing. And this is what would go on. And it seems best to understand it this way. What Jesus is saying is you live at the seat of Roman worship under the threat of death. It's hard to resist, I know. The temptations of just giving in. Also the temptations of just get going to the festivals and eating their foods and participating in their sensual entertainments. But trust me, it'll be worth the wait. If you will endure, I've got food being served. It's secret. It's hidden. You haven't seen it yet. It's going to be really good. And I'm going to give you your own white stone. You will have VIP access. You can come in on my permission. And then he adds, there's going to be a name written on that stone. The only one who I've told about it when I give it to you will be you. No one else will know what it is at that point. I won't have told anyone else yet. You'll be the first to hear it. Which may also indicate not just no one else knows the name you got, but no one else may get the name you get. If you don't like your name, maybe you'll like the one Jesus gives you. What name will Jesus give you? What meaning will be in that name that shows his intimate adoption of you, his love for you, his intimate knowledge of you. I walk into the banquet and I am, let's see, I'm this person. Because Jesus says that's who I am. Wow. And when I go in and I enjoy this banquet. Revelation 19, 6 through 9 speaks of this messianic banquet. The great marriage supper of the Lamb, a banquet of all banquets, a festival, a feast of all feasts. VIP access, only those bought by the blood of Christ who overcame the world will have access. And this will beat out any Emmy Awards banquet or any White House banquet, any UN banquet. It's going to beat out any banquet you can conceive of. And you'll have first access. This is front and center in Jesus' mind in many ways. Matthew, Mark, Luke, at the end of each of these books, third to last chapter of each of these three Gospels, Jesus says, I am going to sit down and eat with you at the end. He was looking forward to that meal when he ate his last meal on this earth. We should be motivated by that as well. What should we take away from these lessons tonight? First of all, I want to impress this upon our hearts. Sexual sins are the Trojan horse of Satan in the church. You can have the right doctrine. You can stand for that doctrine. You can be a church that witnesses for the gospel. You can pass out gospel tracts. You can do street preaching. You can do whatever you want to do and take a stand. You can even get thrown into prison and killed for your faith. But watch out for the Trojan horse of sexual sins. Some of the most apparently exemplary Christians have allowed sexual sins into their hearts and undermined their testimony for Christ. We have to be aware of that. And that's why we have to resist the urge to minimize sexual sins. That is the way that Satan most effectively, repeatedly, would infiltrate the nation of Israel. That is also the way that he was going after this very loyal church in a very tough location. This is how he got in, and they actually let it happen. Also, we have to resist the urge, as we resist the urge of sexual sins, resist the urge to minimize sexual sin, first of all, in your personal life. Do not let the Trojan horse in the gate, all right? It always takes you farther than you want to go, makes you stay longer than you want to stay, and costs more than you ever wanted to pay. You've heard that, but it's true. And just don't rationalize. Don't play the game. Don't think about it. Don't look at it. Don't do it. Don't think about it. Don't look at it. And don't do it. It's very important. We have to make sure that we're not tempted to be drawn into these things. It's one thing to watch a movie. It's another thing to sit and watch sexual sins. It's just not a good thing to do, is it? Certain things we can discuss and debate, but I don't know that that's one of them. You say, well, if I don't watch X movie, it's got a lot of stuff in it. If I don't watch it, though, then I won't know what to talk about at work tomorrow, because it's the latest thing out, and that's what they're all going to talk about for the next week. Or the sitcom that's running right now. I won't know anything because I've tried to watch it, and it's got this all over it. Well, either don't watch it or find a way to watch it in which you block all that stuff out, because that's a Trojan horse that you have to be very, very careful with. Balak said, come on in and be entertained by our people. And in the economy of Israel, God said, kill the men. We cannot tolerate that. It's going to ruin us. And so we have to be careful about this. We also have to resist the tendency to minimize sexual sin around us and in the world at large. There's a lot of pressure at work, in politics, online, at home, at school, and in many other scenarios and venues to minimize sexual immorality. We can say, well, I don't do it, but still, what do you think about it? What are your views? What are your opinions? How do you talk about it? Adultery, fornication, any kind of sex before marriage, free sex, homosexuality, pornography, polyamory, bestiality, prostitution, transgenderism, drag queens, abortion as connected to these things, and so on, is all wrong and always wrong. Just because we live in the 21st century hasn't changed God's opinion about that. Or has it changed the nature of these problems? They're still destructive. We have to be very careful about that. As a church, it's tough in a secular society to stand for the truth of the gospel. It's not a popular message. But we can't let that fact cause us to tolerate weakness in morality and let down our guard to be liked by people. Finally, I've already mentioned it, but your future will be worth the wait and struggle. It's hard not fitting in. It's hard resisting false doctrine and secular pressures. It's hard not to mention, too, that resisting sexual temptation is hard. On top of all these challenges, it often appears that non-believers who aren't really concerned about these things, who live this anything-goes life, whatever you want to do is fine with me kind of life, seem to be having a really great time. When we look at that, they're smiling, they're having a great time, and they can do whatever they want. And that's hard. But as Christians, just be tantalized with what Jesus says. There's a great banquet coming. I've got food that doesn't even compare to what the world can serve you. It's hidden manna. And I'm going to give you a VIP, white stone, brand new name, access. And then once that meal is done, by the way, you get to go into his new world that he's going to make. That's like that worldwide, all the time, forever. And enjoy that forever. And in that world, Satan will have a seat nowhere. And you can swear allegiance to the ruler of that state, and it will be God. There will be no conflict of interest anymore. Look forward to that day. Stand for the faith of Christ, but also resist the Trojan horse of sexual immorality and mixing with other pagan religions. I know it's tough keeping both fronts going, but we have to by God's grace. He hates failure on both sides.